Welcome to the World War I History Podcast, produced by the MacArthur Memorial. We invite you to follow us on Twitter at MacArthur1880 or find the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial on Facebook. This podcast was sponsored by the Ernst and Gertrude Tico Charitable Foundation.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Amanda Williams, and joining me is Jim Zobel. And during World War I, General John J. Pershing considered Douglas MacArthur to be his finest battlefield commander and George Marshall to be his finest staff officer. Now, Pershing clearly preferred Marshall to MacArthur in a number of ways, but he also acknowledged that they were very, very different men. To Pershing, Marshall was a great military mind and MacArthur had a warrior mind. The military mind, according to Samuel P. Huntington, exists in a world of grays. In contrast, the warrior mind was something where everything is more black and white and loud and clashing colors at other times. So while both men would go on to have a very long, consequential working relationship together, according to MacArthur biographers, their World War I service sowed a seed of antagonism between them that would have major consequences in the future. And so today, Jim and I are going to be talking about what happened between them in World War I. Was it something serious? Is it something that is documented? Or is it merely an exaggeration born out of the difficulties of their relationship in future decades? So, Jim, let's go ahead and set the stage. Right before the United States enters World War I, Marshall and MacArthur are both young Army officers. MacArthur at the time is a major, Marshall is a captain, and they're both about the same age. MacArthur is a West Point grad, Marshall is a graduate of VMI, and it's already apparent, I think, by 1917 that both young men are very capable. So what are they doing when the war starts?
MacArthur, as we talked about before, he's in the War Department. He's acting as the Army press censor. At that time, he had been on the general staff about 1914. And his job at that time, as we talked about, was working with all the news people and comes down to selling the country on the draft. And that's how he'll get noticed for where he's going to go with the 42nd Division. Marshall, at that time before the war, he's working with General J. Franklin Bell. Bell had been the chief of staff of the Army from like 1906 to 1910. And at this point, he's head of the Department of the East. And what they're doing is they're getting all those officer camps ready, like at Plattsburgh and Madison Barracks, Fort Niagara. These are all those camps that Leonard Wood was really behind, the earlier chief of staff, who was all about preparedness. And Teddy Roosevelt, the former president, really pushed these camps. And that's what Marshall is doing with Bell. He's setting up these camps, finding out all about supplying, all about logistics. You know, he had had experiences over in the Philippines. He had experience in a lot of different places, been to command and general staff school, a lot of things like Douglas MacArthur had done earlier. And he's really in a position that's putting him where he'll be later on, as is MacArthur. You know, they've got different bearings that they're both working with, and they'll know all the same people. Like Bell had been kind of, you know, influential in MacArthur's career as well. He had been pretty good friends with the father, Arthur MacArthur, and they'll just be working through the same kind of channels, but just very divergent. You know, we know that they're at the staff college at the same time, but we don't know if they really know each other. You know, they're doing different things. I'm sure they've heard of each other, but we don't know if they know each other, you know, at that early point.
When the war starts, both are very eager to get to France and participate in what many young officers at the time thought would be the last big war of their career. Now, how does each officer end up in France, and what are their major responsibilities when they get there?
Marshall, when he's working with that General Bell in the Department of the East, he gets picked up by General Siebert. Now, when they declared the war, the 1st Division that they put together is the U.S. 1st Division. And this is going to be commanded by this guy, Siebert. Siebert had been in control of the Panama Canal Zone. He was an engineer, but was just in in that position of where he was as an officer to be put forward as like this divisional commander early on. And so he'll grab Marshall, this guy Siebert, to be his assistant chief of staff of operations at this point. And so as they're putting the first division together down there in Texas, Marshall is really overseeing, again, a lot of the supply, the logistics, putting together everything that the division needs to get overseas, kind of like MacArthur will for the 42nd Division, because as we've talked about before, MacArthur gets noticed because of that working to get the draft sold to the country. And then he's also very instrumental in getting the National Guard over to France. He's very close with Secretary of War Newton Baker, and Newton Baker knows he wants to be in the infantry. And so he's the one that puts him in that chief of staff position for the 42nd Division, which will be that division that has the 26 National Guard units in it. And so both of them will get to France by different routes. Marshall will go with the 1st Division of July, very, very early, going over there to be the 1st Division there with General Pershing and the headquarters that's established over there early on. MacArthur won't get there till about November, early November, with the Rainbow Division that he then puts together on Long Island. So both of these guys will get to France, but Marshall will get there first.
Both young officers managed to anger General Pershing pretty early on in their time in France. Can you tell us about these incidents?
Well, yeah. I mean, it works out good for Marshall, but MacArthur, you never really know what's going on with he and Pershing. When Pershing came to look at the 1st Division, he just went off on General Siebert, the 1st Division, and just let him really have it. And then when he turns his attention on the, the G3, which is Marshall operations, Marshall just lets him have it, that you've got it all wrong. You don't know what's going on here. And, everybody's like, man, you just sabotage your own career. But Pershing liked that, Pershing wanted someone that was going to tell him what was what. And so I think that's what plants that seed in his mind that this is an officer I need in headquarters. Marshall will stay with the 1st Division through July of 1918. He's, people say he's a staff officer, he's only in headquarters, but as that G3 for 1st Division, he not only makes the plans, but he has to visit all those frontline units. He had seen battles in Verdun, and arrived under barrages. He had seen everything it was about, and he wanted to be that regimental commander, like MacArthur will go on to be, like with the brigade command. And Marshall thought he was pretty set up for it. He's very well liked in the division. They know he's a capable officer. When they get rid of Siebert in that December of 1917 and they bring General Bullard in, he'll be a very prominent person under Bullard. And he wants to be that infantry officer in the field and command troops. But everybody just recognizes him for this, brilliant ability to put together operations. He plans the Cantigny operation for the 1st Division. And then that's when he'll get noticed he'd been noticed before. But that's when I think Pershing is like, I need you up at headquarters. And so in July of 18, he's brought to be on Pershing's staff and he'll be like the assistant chief of staff to operations under Fox Connor. And he'll meet all those people that will then work later in his career, like Hugh Drum and Connor and John Prevost Murphy and all these people at headquarters. MacArthur, on the other hand, when he gets to France, and we've talked about this before, that Pershing wants to break up the Rainbow. And like you've said before, he kind of goes outside the realm of his own rank and immediately starts writing the Secretary of War and putting news stories to the paper about, not breaking up the Rainbow. And, people know about this and it's going to irk Pershing a lot, and Pershing likes to be the only star that's shining. And MacArthur is a very capable officer, but, people at headquarters, they call him the show off and stuff. And so then it comes down to that morning after the Lunéville Baccarat sector and Pershing just totally rages on MacArthur. This is the worst division in the army and it's your fault, even though it's not your division. You're the chief of staff, but everybody's following your example. And then, MacArthur at that point is like, he doesn't understand it because he's like, this has to be something with my father. Did they have some kind of falling out? You know, because what have I done? You know, you can't see anything, you know, that he had done. And so, whereas, you know, Pershing has that, you know, kind of shine on Marshall, with MacArthur, it's kind of this tentative, you know, I can see your ability, but man, you just kind of irk me. That's the way it is, you know, but they'll both be, you know, doing the best jobs of anybody, really. You know, they both shine in that AEF.
This is a good lead into this question, but MacArthur really seems to crave Pershing's approval. Clearly Marshall seems to have it, but MacArthur's the one that has to deal with the spectacle of a public humiliation when Pershing dresses him down and is complaining about the 42nd Division.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about the dynamics here. How is MacArthur trying to gain this approval? And in the end, what is each officer learning from Pershing? What are they going to take away from this period?
Under him, they, you know, they gain all the experience that they'll need for the future, you know, how to move. You know, with Marshall, he goes through so many different phases. You know, he's the chief of operations for a division, you know, and then he goes for the whole army, and then he'll go for just the first army. And so he'll have all this experience of how to mobilize things, you know, personnel, all these things that will then lead to what he does in World War II, basically organizing the entire war effort for not only the United States, but basically the Allies in many ways. You know, and Churchill will even say that himself. So, you know, it's not so much what Pershing instills to them as to that experience they gain. MacArthur will gain all that experience on the battlefield and understand that you can never let up. You have to constantly push, you know, because if you don't, then the people behind you that come to relieve you, they're just going to get slaughtered again. And, you know, and you'll see a lot of that in World War II, where he's bouncing all over the place and all those island operations to keep the Japanese off balance, you know, to constantly keep the pressure on. They learn different things that, you know, aren't so much what Pershing instills, but I think they get to that understanding that Pershing is this officer, duty is everything, you know, honor is everything. And they'll both have somewhat of that character when they go into World War II. And I think Marshall will retain it. I think MacArthur, after Bataan Corregidor, he reverts to that, you know, image of that guy behind you, of that guy in the sweater with the muffler and everything. And he'll have to get back to that kind of person to really run Southwest Pacific effectively. I think that they both learn a great deal, but I think it's just that experience of war itself, and they are both very quick learners.
Do Marshall and MacArthur know each other in this war? I mean, we've established that we're not quite sure what their relationship was prior to the war, but in France, do they get to know each other?
Well, I don't think they got to know each other. I know they know of each other, you know, because Marshall's writing a lot of these operations for the whole army, you know, and they'll know that. And especially when you get to later at the end of the war, they'll both definitely know who each other is. But no, I don't think they really know each other. They don't, you know, they're in different places. They know a lot of the same people. Like one of Marshall's best friends is this guy, James Shannon, and he was a 1903 grad of West Point. And, you know, I think he played on either that football team or that baseball team that MacArthur was part of. And so these guys know each other very well. And Marshall said that was the greatest loss that he had in World War II, was losing that guy, his friend, you know, Jim Shannon. A lot of these people that, you know, John Prevost Murphy, he was there at West Point with MacArthur. So they all know a lot of these people that they have in their lives. But I really don't think that they come in, you know, much contact at that point.
There is the story, though, that in the final days of World War One, in that drive to Sedan, MacArthur's 42nd Division gets tangled up with the 1st Division, which Marshall had been part of. This apparently prevents MacArthur from getting to Sedan the way he wanted to finish out his time in World War One. So what's the story here? Is this the root of all those rumors that World War One is this moment of antagonism between them?
Yeah, I think that is the, you know, the basis of it. You know, how much it was at that time, I don't think it's much, because, you know, nobody really says anything about it. And what it was after October and the Rainbow had taken the Côte de Châtillon, they begin the drive again in early November. And this, the Germans are really pulling back. They're going to cross the Meuse at Sedan. And that's one of the main, you know, French places that they want because of the humiliation of the Franco-Prussian War at Sedan. And so the French want to take it. Fourth Army under Gouraud, who MacArthur was very close with, are operating to the left of the American First Army. And so they're pushing on at the time. But the thing is Pershing wants an American division to be the first ones into Sedan. And people know this. He wants it to be to show that, you know, his army is the one that is most predominant at this point. And so what happens is Fox Connor, the operations officer for headquarters, they want to push this. And so they go to First Army, and the head of First Army is Hunter Leggett at this time. And Hugh Drum is his chief of staff. And Connor gets in touch with Drum, and they write up this order about, you know, American divisions moving into Sedan. See, because the 42nd Division had moved right up on the heights. And they were, you know, overlooking Sedan basically at this point, were at that position where they could be. But then when they Fox Hunter gives this order to Hugh Drum has Marshall write up the order, and basically it's saying we want an American division, you know, to be the first into Sedan, and we're going to obliviate all line of organization. And so then 5th Corps commander, Charles Summerall, he wants the 1st Division to be into Sedan before, because that was his old division that he commanded. And so these guys are like, well, just cut across everybody's front. And so you've got, you know, the 42nd, and you've got the French 4th Army. They're moving in line up to the river and Sedan. And all of a sudden, here comes the 1st Division, you know, perpendicular right across them. And they're getting into everybody else's sector. They're botching everything up. It's a total mix up. Hunter Leggett goes crazy because Hugh Drum had never told him he was going to, you know, write this order. And then it's, you know, for the rest of their lives, they're at war over this. And MacArthur hears about what's going on. And so he said he went up towards the front to try and find somebody to end this and get a hold of General Parker, who runs the 1st Division. And then he got captured by the U.S. 1st Division, because MacArthur's got the crunch cap. You know, as you see behind, he looks like a German officer. Now, MacArthur would always say, no, I was never arrested. We figured this thing out. Whereas everybody says, L says, oh, yeah, we arrested him. You know, but regardless, they get it figured out. And the thing is Parker knows what he's doing, you know, cutting across everyone. Summerall knows what they're doing. And everybody's like, you know, why are you doing this? And they're just like, well, we got this order that said we can cut across the lines, you know, just, you know, being obstinate about it. So, I mean, it's a lot their fault. It's a lot Pershing's fault, because he was like, I like the 1st Division as well to be in there. And so then it becomes this big hassle. And the only person that really doesn't say anything or get upset about it is MacArthur. You see all these other times when he was kind of a stickler about, you know, his reputation, but this one, he really laughs off, pretty cool about it. But then a lot of people talk now, you know, is then Pershing puts MacArthur up for major general, you know, and maybe to be commander of the division. Was this some kind of way to, you know, erase all that? Because it does get erased as it is. But, you know, that's just speculation, you know. So, but like you said, does that come back to MacArthur being upset with Marshall, you know, about writing this order? And, you know, I don't think it is. I don't, you know, people will talk about later on when MacArthur shuffles Marshall off to this National Guard post in Chicago, you know, rather than promoting him to Brigadier General. And they say that's the reason, because of that, you know, Sedan episode. But, you know, I think that was something completely different. So, you know, where people look back to antagonism and in World War One, you know, I think it's more MacArthur during the war. You know, he later on when World War II starts, he'll be saying, oh, those guys were from that Chaumont crowd, you know, that headquarters crowd, which was based in Chaumont, France. And so it's not really till like World War II that it seems this stuff starts to play in their mind, mm-hmm. you know, the, you know, Pershing's guys and me and, you know, because when you see in World War II, like we'll talk about in a couple of weeks, Marshall and MacArthur, they, you know, they have their disagreements, but they, you know, they get things going and moving. In World War II, Marshall's like the biggest supporter from MacArthur in the Southwest Pacific. There's a lot said. I think that the things got really goofy after Korea. You know, I think that's where the antagonism really, really comes, because MacArthur could never stomach that Marshall had voted to get him out.
So what I thought was interesting was that Marshall doesn't mention MacArthur at all in his 1923 World War One memoirs. And on the other hand, flash forward to the 1960s in MacArthur's autobiography, he characterizes that order written by Marshall that caused the 1st Division to kind of cross in front of everyone. He characterizes this, and this is a direct quote, ambiguous and extraordinary, an order that precipitated what narrowly missed being one of the great tragedies of American history. Now, that's MacArthur in his finest prose right there. So that's written in the 1960s. But as you said, MacArthur doesn't really mention it at the time, other than to deny that he was under arrest for a little while. And then kind of in the interwar years, it doesn't seem to be an issue between them. So if they didn't really know each other in World War One, if there's no kind of major falling out between them in that war, no irritation, you know, between each other, and if all of that is just kind of this memory in the past, there's no World War One tension between them, right?
Yeah. Because I like we were saying, I don't think they really knew each other. They weren't in the same area, you know. And the only thing that you know, really draws them together at some point is that, you know, thing with the order. But, you know, Marshall wrote it, but, you know, it wasn't Hugh Drum, you know, it was Hugh Drum that told him, you know, what to write, you know, and come in the 60s, you know, when MacArthur's writing reminiscences, you know, I think a lot of that stuff from World War II and Korea dredged itself up, you know, to put him, you know, in that light, you know, that he does, because it gets, you know, MacArthur will always say, no, there was no problem between Marshall and I, you know, but he tells other people big, big difference.
So then why do all of the biographers tend to see World War One as the beginning of the problem? Just because MacArthur in the 1960s is looking back and deciding maybe it is a problem.
I think so. Yeah, I think they, you know, they're looking for, you know, just the first, you know, possible friction between the two. And so they highlight that one. And, you know, if more comes out, you know, that shows that they were talking about each other, you know, during that time, you know, so be it. But, you know, for now, we don't know anything. You know, we don't have any evidence that, you know, that was, that they were that much of consequence to each other, you know, in World War One.
Final thoughts?
Yeah, that, you know, I would recommend if people are interested in read that diary book that Marshall put out about World War One, because you see a lot of things about Pershing in there that you don't see in a lot of places. Pershing could be a real prankster. He could be a real jokester. You know, even as a 4-star general, he liked causing a lot of chaos, you know, when the situation was very lighthearted, you know, but the next morning he'd wake up and it was like, it never happened. I'm the general, you're the lieutenant, you don't say anything, you know, whereas the night before it was like, come on, let's go do this, you know? So it is really funny, and I would recommend it.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you have questions, suggestions, or comments, we want to hear from you. You can find us on Twitter at MacArthur1880, on Facebook as the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, or you can email MacArthurMemorial@norfolk.gov.